Campus FM presents a talk on Mediterranean history organized by the History Department at University of Malta. This lecture is delivered by foreigner expert Professor Abulafia.
Thank you all for coming. Good evening. I'm welcoming you here on behalf of the Department of History at the University of Malta. Forgive my lack of protocol. Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. I welcome you on behalf of the Department of History of the University of Malta and of the British Council. Director Ronnie McAuliffe here has asked me to thank you on his behalf also. This occasion would not have been possible without the generous support of the British Council, which is very proactive in generating these activities. The fact that this is a public talk on the Mediterranean and the history of the Mediterranean also shows the direction that the British Council is going in promoting intercultural exchange. I'd like to thank also Agenda Bookshop, who have been very supportive, even financially, of course, where it matters, in this occasion. We've had Professor Abulafia now. We've made him work quite hard. He gave us two lectures yesterday at the university, a very interesting lecture to undergraduates about multiculturalism in Norman Sicily, and in the afternoon, an equally interesting lecture to our postgraduate students about the sugar trade in the Mediterranean. Today he'll be talking to us about writing the history of the Mediterranean. I'll say something brief about a person who needs no introduction, in effect. I'll just say, however, that Professor Abulafia's, one of his earlier writings, I understand, has been a contribution in Professor Anthony Luttrell's Medieval Malta. It was a paper on Count Henry of Malta. So there's a long association there with this island. He has also contributed later on to a festschrift which we had organized for our venerated colleague, Professor Godfrey Wettinger, for his 70th birthday, 7 years ago. Anyway, without much more ado, I'll just say that I'm very happy that we are here on this occasion talking precisely about the Mediterranean in this Department of History, in this Faculty of Arts, in this university, which has a very old, going decades, tradition of focusing on the Mediterranean. So, without further ado, as I said, I'll give the floor to Professor David Abulafia, who will be talking about writing the history of the Mediterranean, which is something he is actually doing.
Well, thank you very much, and I'd like to reiterate thanks to all the authorities, to the High Commissioner and to the British Council, and to the university, to Agenda Bookshops, to Thames and Hudson, the publisher of the book, which is available outside. What I want to do today is to present you with some thoughts about how one might write the history of the Mediterranean. For that is what I'm trying to do, following an invitation from Penguin to write a book which I have entitled The Great Sea, A Human History of the Mediterranean. The title is the easy part. It points to the importance of the human presence in the Mediterranean, the importance of the individual as the primary actor in Mediterranean history, the importance of the places where people have settled and from which they have established commercial and cultural connections with other settlements. In saying this, I am laying a different emphasis to the enormously influential French historian of the Mediterranean, Fernand Braudel, whose study of the Mediterranean in the age of Philip II of Spain remains one of the most influential works of history of the last century. Braudel's emphasis was on the way the natural features of the Mediterranean molded human experience in a world where not much changed underneath the superficial violence of wars and empire building. However, writing the history of a sea is not like writing the history of a nation or territory, unless you choose to write it in the way Mediterranean history has often been written, as an assemblage of the history of the lands around the Mediterranean. A sea is another matter. It contains transitory human inhabitants, merchants, pilgrims, pirates, war fleets, refugees, missionaries, scholars, tourists who've crossed back and forth the watery space. Sometimes this occupation has involved establishing mastery, gaining control of exits and entrances, such as the Straits of Gibraltar, the Dardanelles, or the Ionian Sea, and patrolling intervening waters to ensure that ships from rival empires or cities do not intrude. And here certainly Malta has played a role, guarding the straits that join the eastern to the western Mediterranean and divide Africa from Europe. And this takes us to another, more numerous, more permanent group of inhabitants, those who live in the many islands moored in the Mediterranean, from Sicily, the largest, to strategic dots such as the Spanish bases off Morocco, not forgetting the great morass of islands out of which Venice came to life, or those who live on steep capes and peninsulas, some of which were once islands in their own right, and which depend largely on the sea for their existence. Ceuta and Gibraltar in the west, Dubrovnik and Trogir in the Adriatic, and so on. To write this history in a connected way is a particular challenge. It is above all the history of human interaction across a space that has brought together many of the great civilizations of antiquity and the rival empires of medieval and modern times, as well as the great monotheistic religions in all their sectarian variety, with merchants often acting as intermediaries between very different cultures, making use, indeed, of those startling differences in order to trade goods that were as exotic on one side of the sea as they were commonplace on the other. And an example of this, which I talked about yesterday, is southern French honey being exchanged for sugar from Syria in the Middle Ages. A more upmarket exchange in the same period was that of European silver for African and Asian gold, reflecting an imbalance in supply that was to help mould the commercial relationships across the Mediterranean by way of trading quarters and consulates established by the Genoese, Catalans, and others in cities such as Bougie in Algeria, Tunis, Alexandria. It was differences then that generated trade, and one would expect no less. To some extent, these differences were determined by physical differences between the hot, dry climate of the southeastern Mediterranean and the more temperate climate of the shores of northern Italy and Provence. But there were also cultural choices that determined what would be grown. Medieval Western Europeans generally saw the land as fit for wheat, the staple crop, but their Islamic predecessors had cultivated cotton, dyestuffs, rice, and other less humdrum products on the same land. And then there were products from far away that were traded across the Mediterranean, such as the spices of the East, seen as the products of a semi-paradise on the edge of the world, or the gold of Africa taken across the Sahara, or slaves from the Black Sea. Greed, the need for cheap labour, the wish to show off, all made these into highly valued commodities within the Mediterranean. As still happens, the rich would go out and buy foreign articles, not because they were necessarily much better in quality or design, but because of their rarity. Sending coals to Newcastle was a common Mediterranean enterprise even in the Bronze Age. Classical and medieval cartographers were in these senses right to see the known world as revolving around the meeting point of Europe, Africa, and Asia in the Mediterranean Sea. This was where religions, economies, and political systems met, absorbed one another, and clashed. Only in the 16th century did the Mediterranean gradually begin to become subsidiary to Atlantic networks of trade and politics. These Mediterranean interactions make a narrative of Mediterranean history different from that which would be supplied by a history of the lands surrounding the Mediterranean. It is an account in which the agents of contact come to the fore. Phoenicians and Etruscans, rather more than pharaonic Egyptians and Hittites. Genoese and Venetians, rather than popes and Holy Roman emperors. Jews of Livorno and Smyrna, no less than Ottoman Janissaries. Yet these groups had an inordinate impact on the fate of empires as well. Carthage was a Phoenician foundation and blocked Greek and Roman attempts at expansion. Venice, once a subject of Byzantium, became lord of a quarter and half a quarter of the Byzantine Empire after the Fourth Crusade in 1204. In the 16th century, the Genoese held the purse strings of the Spanish rulers. Religious cross-currents that deserve close attention include the spread of the Jewish diaspora into the Hellenistic and Roman worlds, notably Alexandria, the underground Christian movement and its transforming role in the later Roman Empire, the arrival of Islam and the conversion of the peoples of North Africa and parts of Southern Europe to a dynamic new faith, while all the time the three religions and, earlier on, paganism, interacted and taught one another elements of theology, moral codes, and even snatches of liturgical music. Singly and en masse, pilgrims moved back and forth across the surface of the Mediterranean. All this points to the importance of the theme of migration within and into the Mediterranean region. Colonists from Greek and Phoenician cities heading westwards to Sicily from the 9th century BC onwards. Germanic peoples settling in Spain, Italy, and North Africa from the 3rd, 4th century AD onwards. Arabs from Yemen and Arabia, Berbers from the Maghreb, Copts from Egypt, settling in Muslim Spain from the 8th century onwards. Crusaders, Venetians, Catalans, and so on. Yet in the 19th century, and particularly the 20th, we begin to see the reverse process on a massive scale, as Mediterranean peoples seek livelihoods in the New World or in Northern Europe, with interesting cultural results, such as the spread of the pizza. If you write the history of a sea, the lead actors are not necessarily the lead actors in the internal history of Spain, Italy, Greece, or the Levant. Especially germane to the argument is the way in which the human presence on the shores and in the islands of the Mediterranean has altered the environment. Just as wastes have been created, new land has been brought under cultivation, such as the Pontine marshes in Italy. Historians need to consider whether gains in one area may have compensated for losses in another. Under the general environmental heading, one should also look at the ports, seeing what harbour facilities are available where, for that has had a substantial influence on the direction and character of trade. Take Corinth, for example, if you can make it out on the map. The major port established by the ancient Greeks as far back as the 7th century BC lay at Lechaion on the Gulf of Corinth on the western side, facilitating contact with the Ionian Sea, the Adriatic, and Italy. And so it's no coincidence that the Corinthians also established colonies in Sicily at Syracuse and in the Ionian Sea at Corfu, Corcara. One should also look at what is in the sea, especially its fish and salt, and relate those foodstuffs to human needs and the development of systems of exchange, even indeed to religious practices. There's marvellous evidence for the massive consumption of fish in Barcelona during Lent in the 15th century. The currents and winds of the Mediterranean determined in significant degree who could arrive where and when, and this both facilitated and blocked trade and the movement of navies. One should bear in mind where the goods that were exchanged were, in many cases, grown and processed. The grain lands of Sicily, the cotton fields of coastal Syria, the sugar plantations of southern Spain or Cyprus. Another major theme in the history of the Mediterranean is the changing means of communication across the sea. Relatively little is known about the design and efficiency of the earliest shipping, since the main evidence consists of rough images on pottery. Discoveries in the Tyrrhenian and Aegean seas have, however, greatly enlarged understanding of the capacity of Greek, Etruscan, Punic, and Roman ships, including shipwrecks found in the Tyrrhenian Sea and off Sicily. There's the difficult question whether improvements in ship design led to an increase in trade as bigger ships became able to sail longer distances. An alternative view is that growing demand stimulated shipbuilders to develop new designs so that the improvements were determined in large degree by wider economic conditions. That's actually the view I would favour. Looking at shipping, it's important to distinguish the role of fast, sleek vessels driven by wind and oar power from that of pot-bellied slow boats full of grain, fish, salt and timber, which kept open the lifelines of many Mediterranean cities. This is as characteristic of the ancient world as it is of the medieval. It's a mistake to think of the trade of Genoa and Venice as, in essence, a luxury trade in silks and spices. Humbler items such as wheat and salt were traded in vast quantities. And in the ancient Mediterranean, the evidence from discoveries of wine amphorae in southern France indicates, for example, how intensive the trade in Etruscan wine became. As an aside, I should mention that the trade in oil and wine was soon followed by the spread of the olive and vine as far west as Spain, where both became implanted in the culture of the ancient Iberians. Linked to this theme, there are important questions about the life of sailors, passengers, and sometimes galley slaves. We have evidence for the duration of voyages at various periods and for the degree of comfort or discomfort involved when people travelled by sea. This evidence often consists of merchant letters, such as the marvellous collection from the Jewish community of 11th and 12th century Cairo, mainly preserved in Cambridge, the so-called Cairo Geniza documents. The emphasis has to be on the human experience of crossing the sea. I'm not presenting you just with a physical history of the Mediterranean. Therefore, my focus is on the people who crossed the sea, and so its effective starting point is the first traders in the Greek islands, searching for obsidian, volcanic glass, as early as the Upper Paleolithic period, and the first settlers in Sicily around 11,000 BC. From evidence for spasmodic navigation, we move to the trade networks of the great civilizations in the eastern Mediterranean, not just Minoans and Mycenaeans in their Greek and Cretan setting, but the appearance of the goods they manufactured in lands further west, such as Italy, as well as their close contact via Cyprus with the Levant, and the role of the Trojan War as possibly a trade war for control of the entrance from the Black Sea into the Aegean, anticipating many later wars for control of Constantinople or Istanbul. At the other end of the Mediterranean, the Straits of Gibraltar were already open to shipping, according to classical writers, from at least 1104 BC, when Cadiz was supposedly founded by the Phoenicians, though this is almost certainly several centuries earlier than was actually the case. This link to the Atlantic was created early and forms a constant theme throughout the human history of the Mediterranean Sea. It becomes a dominant one after 1492 and the discovery of America. The Mediterranean is not a closed world, but one that via the Black Sea has links to the steppes, as Brodel pointed out, and via the Atlantic to Northern Europe and West Africa. That, in essence, is why the Mediterranean is so important. What happens there has an economic, cultural, and political impact far beyond. One might indeed write Mediterranean history not as the history of the Mediterranean Sea, but as the history of Mediterraneans, that is, of seas that act as bridges between cultures and peoples. In an article I wrote not very long ago, I identified several other middle seas, such as the Baltic, the Caribbean, the Japan Sea, and though a look at the map may not make this obvious, the Indian Ocean, which has been analysed by an English scholar, Chowdhury, using the methods and concepts of Fernand Braudel. The point is that territories facing one another across an easily traversable waterway may have developed in very distinctive ways, but enter into contact with one another and transform one another through trade, migration, and sometimes military conquest. A good example might be the way medieval Sicily drew on the influence of both Byzantium and Islam, for it contained a mixed population of Greeks and Muslims, eventually conquered by Latin Christians, and the court culture of these new rulers was impregnated with Islamic and Byzantine motifs. Looking at other middle seas, we can see similar processes by which cultures across the water assumed a dominant role. A good example is the powerful influence of Korean, and in particular Chinese culture, on Japan, across the open spaces of the Japan Sea. This picture is not confined to watery open spaces. The dry open spaces of the Sahara and Gobi deserts also acted as metaphorical seas across which ideas, objects, and people move. The famous gold trade across the Sahara heading north to the Maghreb, while the Maghreb exported, among much else, its dominant ideas, notably Islam. Finally, it is important to remember that Mediterraneans were created as the network of communications across the world grew. The great example here is the Atlantic. Before 1492, the eastern and western shores were not in contact, occasional Viking voyages apart. After 1492, not just Europe but Africa developed a fateful trading relationship with the Americas, based in significant measure on the tragic export of human cargoes to Brazil, the Caribbean, and North America. Nowadays, of course, just about everywhere seems to be in contact with everywhere else. Air travel in particular has shrunk the world, and in a sense, the whole world has become Mediterraneanized. Yet the Mediterranean Sea is the classic Mediterranean, not just because it carries the name, but because it was there that the most intense contacts came into being, which saw the birth of Western civilization. Here, three continents meet in close proximity. A 10-minute boat ride takes you from European Istanbul to Asian Istanbul. Morocco stands clearly visible from the Rock of Gibraltar. And on a clear day, Africa can be seen from Erice in western Sicily. The meeting of three continents in the Atlantic Mediterranean, as it's sometimes been called, is neither so intimate nor so ancient. Against 500 years of Atlantic history, we can set well over 5,000 years of contact across the Mediterranean, maybe much more. The Mediterranean, therefore, has a certain primacy. Now, Braudel's Mediterranean was seen from the perspective of the late 16th century, even though this was combined with a view of the Mediterranean as a place where, he says, all change is slow. But the strength of Braudel's treatment lies in his mastery of the physical setting. In his hands, even the history of trade becomes the history of commodities rather than of the commodities and the merchants who traded them. The human dimension seems to me strangely lacking. And this has established a tradition, clearly visible in dozens of impressive works by French scholars of the Annales school, whose studies of Mediterranean cities such as Livorno in Italy, Bougie in Algeria, Valencia in Spain, have stressed the permanent structures underlying trade and social relations in whatever period they have been examining. The danger is that one then fails to demonstrate clearly changes over time. For instance, in the case of Valencia, the ups and downs of the trade in slaves or sugar. There's also a tendency to set aside political developments. A classic case of this is a rich and impressive study by Jacques Herse of the Sorbonne of 15th century Genoa, where the tumultuous politics of the city, which certainly had an impact on trade and social relations, are relegated to a few pages at the end, whereas the trade in grain and metals and slaves is given full exposure in the main text. This school of historians has left a powerful legacy in historical writing in Italy, Spain, and England, as well as in France. The British scholars Peregrine Horden and Nicholas Purcell, in their substantial recent work, The Corrupting Sea, have written primarily for an academic audience of archaeologists and early medieval historians, and they have a very fine command of the geographical realities, of the enormous variety of settings in which the inhabitants of the Mediterranean lived, but once again, there is far less on the inhabitants than on the setting. Treatment is thematic, with sections on irrigation, vegetation, and so on. But there is no narrative. The assumption is that the Mediterranean world consists of the lands around the Mediterranean to the depth of a couple of dozen miles, as well as the seas themselves. So in the last analysis, we are pulled back to the history of the Mediterranean lands rather than the history of the Mediterranean Sea. A further example of this approach comes from the pen of a skilled archaeologist whose work is rightly esteemed in Malta, David Trump, in his short survey of the prehistory of the Mediterranean. This book takes one further than Horden and Purcell inland, though not as far as Brodel, whose Mediterranean, on one memorable occasion, reaches Krakow in Poland, not to mention Madeira out in the Atlantic. The insights of all these authors need, therefore, to be subsumed into a long-term narrative. Yet this is emphatically not a political narrative built around wars for control of the seas. That is an important part of the story, but by no means the whole story. There have been attempts to let the high politics dominate the story, most recently in a popular account by John Julius Norwich entitled The Middle Sea. His book, I regret to say, disappoints on several grounds. It's rather bitty, a series of narratives built around characters such as Frederick II and events such as the Battle of Lepanto in 1571. He's not greatly interested in traders and their goods, nor indeed in the ancient world, when so many of the major characteristics of the Mediterranean economy came into existence, notably the great trade in grain. I come to these issues, however, as somebody who is seriously interested in economic connections, but I hope I've always tried to understand the documents as transactions between people, not just transactions about goods. Is the writing of the history of the Mediterranean a task for one person? Not long ago, I edited a large glossy volume, which you can see outside, entitled The Mediterranean in History, which appeared in English, Spanish, French, German, Greek, and Turkish editions. There I entrusted chapters on the ancient, medieval, and early modern Mediterranean to a series of authors from several countries. But even with some direction from the editor, it is difficult to impose a common view. Authors may not share one's own view, and there's a real advantage in letting authors express their own conception of how Mediterranean history should be written. That then allows the opportunity for a debate to develop about what the central issues of Mediterranean history might be. Thus, the chapter on the early Middle Ages emphasizes the migration of the barbarian peoples, and less is said than I would have done, if I'd written it, about the argument that the economic links between the Western and Eastern Mediterranean were fractured in this period, what historians call the parenthesis. However, arguments in favor of a study of the history of the Mediterranean written by one person are straightforward. There are recurrent themes that enable someone who has specialized in the medieval period to understand what happened in earlier and later periods, and dare I suggest this, in the presence of people who know far more about archaeology than I do, even to shed some light on those other periods. A good example of this is provided by the merchant colonies which characterized the Mediterranean in the 12th to the 15th centuries. These have certain basic structural similarities with those established in the ancient Mediterranean by the Phoenicians and the Greeks. At the human level, the way they interact with the surrounding native population, from the moment that the settlers established a political rapport with the native ruler of the territory, to the time when, as at Carthage, we see increasing intermingling between settlers and natives, creating a distinctive new Punic culture. And we can compare this with the experience of the Genoese in Chios or the Venetians in Crete in the late Middle Ages and early modern period. Then there are questions of method. The historian of later periods is likely to raise his or her eyebrows when reading some of the classic studies of the Bronze Age Mediterranean. Foolhardy of me to talk about the Bronze Age, but I will, if only because there's such a tendency to fill gaps in the evidence with sentences beginning, "Could it not have been the case that," which is often evidence for the general lack of evidence. A favourite grammatical form of classical historians is "will have," and here's a real example from a book on ancient Corinth. "The men who conducted the eastern trade will have been far more variable." I take "will have" to mean that the author has no evidence at all, really, and this is just a plausible assumption. I would like to think that is really what he's saying. It does no harm if a historian of a later period insists rather more heavily on hard data to prove an assertion. Someone outside the circle of specialists is well placed to ask the question whether the emperor is wearing real clothes. A good instance of this is provided by the voluminous debate on the so-called Sea Peoples who attacked Egypt, Syria, and other lands in the 12th century BC. On closer example, it is clear that very many of them were land peoples rather than sea peoples, and that some of those who arrived by sea came from the Mycenaean Greek world, which was entering a great crisis linked in some way to the Trojan War. But this does not justify treating the Trojan War as hard history, as Barry Strauss, a professor at Cornell University, has recently done, reading the Iliad more in the spirit of the ancient Greeks than in that of modern historians and archaeologists. How then would one construct such a narrative of Mediterranean history without making it into a history simply of the lands around the Mediterranean? Brodel's Mediterranean had its centre of gravity in the 16th century. He did not seek to provide a grand narrative, nor did he really think it necessary. He did, it is true, write a book on the ancient Mediterranean, first published in Paris in 1998, a few years after his death, and soon republished in English by my own publisher, Penguin. But it was, frankly, a distillation of earlier studies. For example, the chapter on the Etruscans betrays the strong influence of works by his former colleague Raymond Bloch, who was a relative of one of the founders of the Annales school, Marc Bloch. It was also a history of the lands around the Mediterranean, which was perhaps hinted at in the title in English, The Mediterranean in the Ancient World, though the French title was the altogether more mysterious Mémoire de la Méditerranée, proving that what really sold his books was his illustrious name. My own narrative of the Mediterranean is built around the idea that the Mediterranean was refashioned several times. So there's a first, second, third Mediterranean, and so on. Each of these represents a phase of human activity. For me, the history of the Mediterranean does not exist until human beings are crossing the sea, and the earlier geological history of the space, though relevant as background, tells one the design of the stage, but it would be dangerous to infer too much about who will come and strut upon that stage. These phases might at first sound a little like the stages in social development posited by Marxist historians. Periods of growth, followed by the breakdown of the old order and the fashioning of a new economic and social regime as slave-owning societies gave way to feudal ones and they gave way to bourgeois capitalist ones. In Marxist historical writing, the underlying feature of all societies is class, and class is primarily defined by economic function. Those at the bottom, it is assumed, are visibly or invisibly coerced by those at the top. And it's assumed that in each stage of society there are internal contradictions that lead to the collapse, often violent, of the old order as class antagonisms express themselves. It will be obvious from what follows that my own system of stages or phases in the history of the Mediterranean owes little or nothing to those ideas. I echo the words of a great Cambridge historian, Sir Michael Postan. "You can find capitalists," he said to me, with a little exaggeration, admittedly, "in the Linear B tablets from Crete in the 12th century BC, as also in the commercial contracts of Genoa from the 12th century AD. You cannot project backwards the economic and social tensions of 19th century Europe to explain the rise and decline of civilizations several millennia earlier." That said, it's not at all easy to explain the strains that led to the collapse of the Bronze Age civilizations in the Mediterranean around 1150 BC, nor to explain the fall of the Roman Empire, nor the economic convulsions of the late Middle Ages, all major stages in the transformation and renewal of the Mediterranean civilizations. We can begin with a first Mediterranean in which human beings opened up contact across the watery spaces, reaching the islands and even opposite shores, but not at this time drawing the entire space into a single system. The far west remained largely isolated from the eastern Mediterranean till the end of the Bronze Age, around 1100 BC or even later. In fact, the first evidence for trade across the Mediterranean takes us back to the Upper Paleolithic, later Stone Age or even earlier, when people first visited Melos in the Aegean in search of the volcanic glass, known as obsidian, used in toolmaking. Since Melos is an island, we have immediate evidence for a rich and regular trade, or, well, trade perhaps isn't the right word, but movement of small boats linking this island to the mainland of Greece and Asia. Out of this, they eventually, much later in the Bronze Age, developed a lively island civilization whose boats were drawn in outline on surviving fragments of stone and pottery, and which was the source of the extraordinary Cycladic sculptures, simple and stylized, which still have the power to move modern observers. But if we're in search of personalities, the age of the Cycladic sculptors offers us no names or identities, and the same is true of other early civilizations of the Neolithic and Bronze Age Mediterranean. The builders of the great temples of prehistoric Malta, the creators of much later of the thousands of towers and castles in prehistoric Sardinia known as the Nuraghi. Lacking writing, they do not speak to us, even assuming we could understand their languages. The close of the period of the first Mediterranean is marked by conflict and possibly by migration, by a breakdown in trade, and by the fall of great cities. Here we can focus on an event which belongs at least as much to legend as to fact, but a legend whose persistence within and beyond the Mediterranean is itself an important feature of Mediterranean history, the Trojan War. Most likely a battle for control of access to the straits leading out of the Mediterranean and into the Black Sea, an area that would remain of vital importance to the history of the Mediterranean through the Byzantine and Ottoman eras. The traditional date of 1184 BC, furnished by classical authors, seems to stand up reasonably well. Recent studies of the site of Troy reveal that Schliemann's excavations in the 19th century were limited to the princely citadel, and that there did indeed exist a substantial city at the foot, guarding the straits, rearing its horses, as Homer said, and poised between two political worlds, that of the Achaeawa, or Achaeans, the Mycenaean Greeks, and that of the Hittites of the Anatolian interior. Here we enter a world in which writing was used, and the surviving documents in Hittite and very early Greek can be interpreted. The archaeological evidence is confirmed by references in Hittite records to Taruisha and Wilusa, which are generally, though not universally, taken to indicate Troy and Ilios, or Wilios in its earlier form, the city's other name. Homeric memories of the Trojan War were also expressed in a wider Mediterranean legend, the story of the travels of Odysseus, which include what some have read as descriptions of the waters around Sicily and southern Italy, a region in which many examples of Mycenaean Greek pottery from the time of the Trojan conflict have been found. Pirates, merchants, and migrants found their way gradually further and further west in this age of maritime pioneers. But the chaos ascribed by the Greek authors to this age extended further afield. I have already mentioned the sea peoples, among whom the most famous were the Philistines, probably of Greek origin, who settled the coast of Canaan and gave it their name in the modern form of Palestine. The collapse of the great Bronze Age civilizations of the Eastern Mediterranean marks the end of the First Mediterranean. A Second Mediterranean emerged as the Phoenicians and later the Greeks reopened the trade routes to the west, planting themselves in colonies in North Africa, in Sardinia, Sicily, southern Italy, Spain, and southern France. Thus, in this phase, the extent and scale of contacts was far greater than in the days when occasional Mycenaean traders had reached Taranto in southern Italy or eastern Sicily. Of course, the opening of these routes was a competitive business, and the Trojan War was only the first of many commercial conflicts, the predecessor of yet more aggressive campaigns, which brought Greek fleets against Etruscan and Carthaginian ones in the waters around Sicily and southern Italy. Greek also fought against Greek, for ethnic loyalties were never paramount. The life of the inhabitants of Mediterranean Spain and northwest Africa was transformed from the 8th century BC onwards by the coming of merchants buying local produce, foodstuffs and raw materials in the main, and selling fine pottery and products of artisan workshops and olive oil and wine. The major evidence for the creation of new networks is provided by the Phoenicians, who from bases in modern Lebanon established not merely commercial routes but daughter cities. Colonies is a word better avoided because it implies control from afar. Colonies as far, or cities as far afield as North Africa. There they established the Kart Hadash, or new city, later known to the Romans as Carthage, and eventually further secondary centres in Spanish waters. For instance, on the Spanish mainland, a new city emerged at Cartagena, not to mention other towns with Punic echoes in their name, like Barcelona. The Phoenicians must be seen as vectors for the grander cultures of the Middle East, Egyptian and Mesopotamian, whose goods they distributed, and perhaps even more significantly imitated, in their own workshops. Commercial outposts came into existence. Typically, these outposts were offshore islands, or at least perched on the edge of the territory with which the Phoenicians and others sought to trade. We can look, for example, at Motia off the western coast of Sicily, an important base for Phoenician and Carthaginian merchants. The need for safety and the wish to be masters of their own small enclave determined this behaviour. What is exciting is the way we see this pattern replicated in much later centuries in the trading settlements of the Italian and Iberian merchants of the late Middle Ages. And the technique was to spread far beyond the Mediterranean in the hands of the Portuguese in the early modern period. I am thus constantly struck by the similarities between the way the Phoenicians operated and the way the Venetians and Genoese were to operate 2,000 years later within the same Mediterranean space. Another point of comparison between Phoenicians and Venetians is the link between merchants and writing. The ancient Greeks, with some justice, attributed the invention of the alphabet to the Phoenicians. The alphabet, it can be argued, broke the near monopoly of priests and other select groups on writing systems, until then very complex, esoteric. And the spread of the alphabet westwards is one of the great themes in early Mediterranean history. The dominant theme in the history of the Mediterranean in the 7th to 2nd centuries BC must be the struggle for political dominion in the east between Athens and its rivals, a struggle that extended to the Adriatic and to Sicily, and conflicts in western waters in which Greeks, Carthaginians, Etruscans, and later Romans were the main actors. These struggles were largely effected through naval contests because at their heart lay the opportunity to gain control of the trade routes and the profits they brought. Especially important was the creation of the Greek colonies, bearing in mind that they were largely autonomous, in such places as Syracuse, Taranto, Cumae, the area known as Greater Greece, Magna Graecia. The Sicilian colonies furnished large amounts of grain to sustain growing cities such as Corinth and Athens. Beginning in the Bay of Naples, it was in Magna Graecia that the Greeks built trading and cultural ties to less sophisticated peoples who became heavily influenced by Greek practices. The adoption of forms of Greek script by the Etruscans and others is just one example. Another important example is the export of Greek religious ideas, anthropomorphic gods and goddesses, and a rich treasury of myths which were grafted onto local gods in Italy and elsewhere. In entering these waters, the Greeks competed with others, the Phoenicians and the Etruscans in particular. Sometimes they worked side by side, as at Spina in the northern Adriatic, not terribly far from Venice, which became a great Etruscan centre for the import of Greek pottery. But there were violent clashes too. I think of the great battle between the Greeks of Syracuse and the Etruscans at Cumae in 474 BC. This therefore sets out a consistent theme. Very many of the rivalries within the Mediterranean were rooted in commercial competition. But it was not necessarily a question of controlling gold and perfumes. More important to early Rome was salt, while the Etruscans were famous for their massive iron reserves, notably on and around Elba. Thus, we can see early on that the trade of the Mediterranean, contrary to the assumptions of many classic works, has to be understood not just as the exchange of luxuries, but as commerce in humdrum necessities such as foodstuffs and raw materials. Competition and trade wars were a repeated reality, but there were also periods of relative stability. In such a period, a hybrid culture developed in the eastern Mediterranean following the conquests of Alexander the Great and the establishment of Greek rule over Egypt and Syria. The cosmopolitan city of Alexandria, home to Hellenistic Greeks, Jews, Copts, and many others, demands close attention. Its great library was an expression of the cultural unity that developed in the Hellenistic world despite ethnic and religious tensions. An interesting symbol of Alexandrian culture was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, the Septuagint, created for a Jewish community that was no longer very familiar with Hebrew. So too, the philosopher Philo brought together Jewish and Greek ideas in a series of works which exerted a powerful influence later on Christian Byzantine culture. The Hellenistic period was the period in which the foundations were laid for the Mediterranean Empire of the Romans and indeed of the Byzantines, as a Greek-speaking city-based civilization emerged in the eastern Mediterranean. Meanwhile, real political power had shifted away from independent city-states into the hands of regional monarchs. The spread of cults, such as that of the Egyptian goddess Isis, provides marvelous evidence of the movement of people and ideas across the ancient Mediterranean. Clearly, Rome itself cannot be ignored. Its political mastery of the Mediterranean was consolidated by the fall of both Greece and Carthage in 146 BC, and its economic interests were furthered by the establishment of Roman rule in Egypt. The famous wheat trade out of Egypt and Sicily must be mentioned here. How far was Rome seeking to protect the interests of the mother city? How far did it have a wider interest in the creation of a great commonwealth around the shores of the Mediterranean? Regions such as Gaul, Britain, and Western Germany were peripheral to an empire whose centre of gravity was at first Rome and then moved eastwards to Constantinople, thereby confirming the vitality of the old Hellenistic lands of the eastern Mediterranean. This was an area dotted with towns, long used to intensive commercial exchanges, which would continue even with the emergence of Islam and the loss of Byzantine Egypt and Syria in the 7th century. The theme of the second Mediterranean is then the integration of the entire Mediterranean space into an interconnected trading area, culminating in the creation of something even more ambitious, an integrated political area under the rule of the Roman emperors. The origins of the third Mediterranean must not surprisingly be sought in the political and economic fragmentation visible from the 4th century onwards. Constantinople, the new Rome, retained its mastery over the eastern Mediterranean until the rise of Islam, but what was lost after a millennium of trans-Mediterranean trade was intimate contact between the far west and the far east of this sea. So I move from a period of unification, political, economic, and cultural, to one of fragmentation, as Byzantium lost many of its most precious possessions in the Near East and in Western Europe, though later on the rise of Islam did unify much of the Mediterranean in ways reminiscent of the Roman Mare Nostrum. To some extent, Islam was able to restore the East-West contact once most of Spain fell under Muslim rule in the 8th century. But north-south contact declined, and links between Christian Western Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean weakened greatly. We enter the murky waters of the so-called Dark Ages. Historians have argued passionately for and against the collapse of trade following the barbarian invasions of the 5th century onwards. And the answer you give depends significantly on your point of view. The perspective from the Bay of Naples, a centre of continuing trade, is different to that from the still quiescent ports of northern Italy. Under Islam, a common market stretching from Spain and Morocco to Egypt and Syria was created, which also enjoyed close commercial ties to the Byzantine world in the eastern Mediterranean and southern Italy. There were significant bonds between the Greek and Islamic worlds in the realms of high culture, where Arab translators helped preserve Greek texts by the way of Aramaic translations, and lower down the scale, where Orthodox priests and monks formed part of a rich mixed culture within Islamic lands, alongside Jews and, of course, increasing numbers of Muslims. Here again, we see one of the recurring themes of Mediterranean history, the Mediterranean as a theatre for cultural and religious mixing, sometimes, as at this period, expressed through the emergence of a degree of mutual tolerance. This, however, was not automatically the case. Eastern Christian monks arriving in early Muslim Spain spurred local Christians to denounce Islam in public, setting off the crisis of the martyrs of Cordoba in the 9th century that badly damaged Christian-Muslim relations. Pursuing the theme of unity, I move into a period from about 950 AD when we observe unity within diversity. Sects multiplied, and so there rapidly ceased to be one Islam, just as there had already ceased to be one Christianity. Yet this remained a relatively stable world, economically united despite sharp political divisions between Umayyads, Fatimids, Abbasids, and other claimants to the title of caliph. Among those who crisscrossed the Mediterranean at this period were pilgrims of the three monotheistic faiths, some of whom, such as Ibn Jubayr and Benjamin of Tudela, a Muslim and a Jew from Spain, have left vivid accounts of their travels in the age of the Crusades. Large-scale Christian pilgrimage across the Mediterranean to the Holy Land preceded the First Crusade, launched in 1095, and was further stimulated by the Crusade's startling success in capturing Jerusalem in 1099. Into this world, the Italian merchants, and alongside them, crusaders and other conquering knights, erupted aggressively at the end of the 11th century. Their activities dominate the Mediterranean in the central Middle Ages. Yet this should not be presented entirely as a history of fragmentation. The rise of Italian trade is once again the history of the forging of commercial unity within the Mediterranean, the creation of that third Mediterranean to which I have been alluding, as the Italians and later the Catalans and Provençal merchants seized mastery of the trade routes from the Muslims and Jews and created their own trading bases in such cities as Crusader Acre, Constantinople, Alexandria, Tunis, and Palermo. For once they had gained their trading bases, the Pisans, Genoese, and Venetians sought peaceful relations with their Muslim trading partners and were often criticized in Western Europe for the warmth of their ties with Muslim states such as Fatimid Egypt. Alexandria lived off the profits of the Levant trade, selling to Western merchants goods obtained from the Indian Ocean, notably pepper. The ties between the Catalans and the rulers of the Maghrib became so close that the Catalans even supplied mercenary armies to fight on behalf of the Muslim allies of the Christian kings of Aragon. On the other hand, the self-confidence of Christian Western Europe was expressed as well in the conquest of the Balearic Islands and of the coastline of Spain, Mallorca in 1229, Valencia 1238, and so on. These were lands that had been held by Islam for about half a millennium, and they were the seat of that remarkable civilization of conviventia, living together, forged in medieval Spain, where, for example, Christian scholars studied Arabic texts with the help of Jewish and Muslim scholars, though I'm well aware of the dangers of over-romanticizing the degree of mutual tolerance at this time. As we move beyond 1200, the history of the Mediterranean increasingly becomes a history of vigorous and violent competition among Christians as well, seen in the struggle between Genoa and Venice for control of Crete at the start of the 13th century, in which your own Count Henry of Malta was involved, or in the Battle of Meloria in 1284, when the Genoese defeated their age-old rivals from Pisa and for a time gained control of Elba, which was so rich in iron. It's important not to forget that the Christians of the East were victims of the Crusades as well, notably when the Fourth Crusade sacked Constantinople in 1204, a blow from which the Byzantine capital never really recovered. Further west, bloody battles between Catalans and Genoese for control of Sardinia, which was valued for its grain, cheese, and leather, spared nobody and resulted in gory massacres of sailors and their passengers on enemy ships. The history of piracy in this period certainly repays close attention, especially since much of this piracy was actually licensed under the auspices of such eminent protectors as the King of Aragon or the Republic of Genoa. My provisional view is that this third phase came to a dramatic end in the mid-14th century, when the Black Death wiped out what's now thought to have been up to half of the population of the lands bordering the Mediterranean. The whole economy of Christian Europe and the Islamic lands was reconfigured in remarkable ways. So a fourth Mediterranean began to develop at this stage. some of the grand trunk routes declined and a new configuration came into being as local trade routes came to the fore. And all this was related to major political events in the East as the Turks gained control of the Aegean and interfered with access to such products as sugar, which now had to be sought out nearer home in Sicily, Granada, and even outside the Mediterranean in Madeira. Most importantly, we know that with reduced population, there were less mouths to feed and there was more money to spend on luxuries. So it was not just the routes that changed, it was also what was carried and where it was carried. Valencia became a boom town, while Marseille and Pisa experienced decline. The interweaving of major political and naval developments with the ebb and flow of trade is the constant theme of Mediterranean history. We also begin to see the gradual emergence of the Atlantic as a destination for Mediterranean merchants and conquerors, with important results for the relationship between the Mediterranean and the wider world, even before Columbus crossed the ocean in 1492, which was also a year of fateful importance for the religious history of the Mediterranean, since it saw the destruction of the Muslim kingdom of Granada, the last Muslim state in Spain, and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, many thousands of whom moved to Ottoman lands. One can certainly argue that the creation of a vibrant Atlantic economy transformed the Mediterranean as much as the Black Death. The Fourth Mediterranean was increasingly linked to the Atlantic, and as new spice routes opened through the Atlantic, Mediterranean cities found themselves competing with Lisbon and eventually Antwerp in the spice trade to the disadvantage of the Mediterranean. The 16th and 17th centuries have always tended to be seen from the perspective of the conflict between Christendom and Islam, culminating in the Battle of Lepanto in 1571. And yet beneath this ruffled surface, the old unities still survived. Trade between East and West through Livorno, Smyrna, Dubrovnik, cultural contact, as Westerners expressed their fascination with things Turkish, a degree of political accommodation in the 17th century when Spain was preoccupied with political problems elsewhere in America, Italy, the Netherlands. So Livorno and Smyrna were opened up to merchants of all religions, cities in which political conflicts were often pushed aside to make way for exchange and profit. Dubrovnik functioned as a hinge, linking the Ottoman Balkans to Western Europe and enjoying a degree of political autonomy within the Turkish sphere of influence. However, these successes served as the prelude to the arrival of non-Mediterranean powers in the Mediterranean. By the 18th century, the Mediterranean was emerging as a battleground of powers whose main activities lay in the oceans beyond. And the rise of British naval power in this period cannot be ignored, following the capture of Gibraltar in 1704, right through to Nelson's role in the Battle of the Nile, and indeed at Trafalgar, not far from the entrance to the Mediterranean, and the British occupation of Malta, of course. This was all the prelude to extraordinary changes in the 19th century, which saw the radical transformation of the Mediterranean. My fifth Mediterranean, as Britain and France worked together to make it into a middle sea in a new way, opening up the Suez Canal and permitting at long last the traffic of shipping from Europe to Asia without the need to circumnavigate the whole of Africa. Industrialization in Northern Europe stimulated demand for raw materials from the East, which now passed straight through the Mediterranean. Thus, the Mediterranean gained new importance as a passageway rather than as a region whose resources were valued in their own right. And yet, in a sense, an old relationship had been restored. The products of the Indies once again flowed in great quantities up the Red Sea towards Port Said rather than Alexandria, as had been the case in the Middle Ages, before the Portuguese opened the pepper route around Africa. Nonetheless, Alexandria became an economic powerhouse after centuries of quite startling decline. Its new inhabitants, Greeks, Jews, Italians, Turks, Maltese, Copts, saw themselves as standing apart from the life of Egypt and very consciously recalled the classical description of their city as Alexandria ad Egyptum, Alexandria on its way to Egypt, rather than in Egyptum, Alexandria in Egypt. Meanwhile, the colonial powers gradually strengthened their hold on territories around the Mediterranean, starting with French Algeria from as early as 1830, and continuing to the eve of the First World War when Italy battled for control of Libya. Alexandria, too, was in effect managed by the great powers as a condominium. At the same time, the Mediterranean entered the consciousness of Europeans in new ways. As the birthplace of Greek, and therefore it was assumed of European culture, notions which were confirmed by the discoveries of Schliemann and Evans at Mycenae, Troy, and Knossos, either side of 1900. It became clear that the history of the Greek world receded further back in time than anyone had imagined. And the history of travel in the Mediterranean, from the time of Odysseus onwards, culminated in the coming of mass tourism during the late 20th century, and the emergence of the Mediterranean as a playground for Europeans and Americans of all social classes. That is one note on which one could end, but new developments make me think of other possible endings. President Sarkozy and others have talked grandly of a Mediterranean Union alongside and overlapping with the European Union, and the Barcelona process has initiated discussion of environmental problems in a setting where old enemies such as Israel and Libya are encouraged to sit together at the same table. Whether they agree to do so is another question. This offers an optimistic vision for a future in which Malta will also play a role. Fitting all of this into a single volume is obviously a challenge. And the way forward is to identify some of those places that played a key role in the evolution and transformation of the Mediterranean in each of these phases. Good candidates at the start of the story include, not surprisingly, Malta and its temples, as well as the Cycladic Islands with their remarkable early sculptures. Troy, which has been picked over so many times by archaeologists, and which was so heavily involved in the struggles that saw the end of the Bronze Age. Moving into the period of recovery, the second Mediterranean, it makes sense to look closely at the Phoenician cities that opened up the vast tracts of the Mediterranean, beginning with Tyre and continuing with Carthage. Among Greek centres, Corinth, looking in both directions from its twin ports on the west and east of the isthmus, is of capital importance. This is not to underestimate the importance of Athens as a cultural, political, and economic centre. Rather, it is an attempt to see Athens' role in its proper proportions, not to let Athens dominate the writing of the history of that part of the Mediterranean. The examples can be multiplied for the Middle Ages, Genoa, Barcelona, Mallorca, for the 16th and 17th centuries, Dubrovnik, Livorno, and Smyrna, much more recently, the Alexandria of Durrell, as well as Salonika. These are all places whose significance was much more than local, places that helped create networks of contact stretching right across the Mediterranean and indeed out through its points of exit into the Black Sea, the Atlantic, and the Nile Delta. Many of them are also places where Christians, Muslims, and Jews intermingled in modern times. I've mentioned Alexandria and Salonika, the two great examples, and where meeting and mixing took place in more remote times as well, as at Alexandria, where Greeks and Jews lived side by side in the Hellenistic period, or the cities of Mediterranean Spain in the days of Al-Andalus, Muslim Spain. In summary, then, my consistent theme in a narrative of Mediterranean history would be ways in which the Mediterranean brings together peoples, religions, economies, offering a grand marketplace for the exchange of not just goods, but ideas and religions. The business of trade can survive even through the shock of violent conflict, as during the period of Carthaginian power, during the period of the Crusades, or at the time of Philip II of Spain. The Mediterranean built close ties to the Atlantic from the 15th century onwards, and these ties transformed its economic and political character. The coexistence of religions often generated, at least unofficially, a pragmatic tolerance which enabled peoples of different faiths to live side by side, and more than that, to read each other's books and adopt or adapt their ideas. These themes supply evidence that there is a fundamental unity in the history of the Mediterranean that is determined not simply by its physical configuration. The Mediterranean has always been a grand theatre of human interaction. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk on Mediterranean history organized by the History Department at University of Malta. This lecture was delivered by foreigner expert Professor Abulafia.